1 o'clock having arrived, I'm going to call the February 2nd, 2022 meeting of the Taxes Committee to order under House Rules 10.01 dealing with remote hearings. Members, welcome back to the best committee in the legislature. And with that, I'm going to ask Ms. Griska to please call the roll.
Representative Marquardt.
Marquardt present.
Representative Marquardt present. Representative Lisselgard.
Present.
Representative Lisselgard present. Representative Davids.
Davids present.
Representative Davids present. Representative Agbaje. Representative Carlson.
Carlson present.
Representative Carlson present. Representative Detmer.
Present.
Representative Detmer present. Representative Garofalo.
Garofalo present.
Representative Garofalo present. Representative Gomez.
Gomez present.
Representative Gomez present. Representative Herr.
Herr present.
Representative Herr present. Representative Hertas. Representative Howard.
Hertas present.
Representative Hertas present, and Representative Howard is present. Representative McDonald.
McDonald present.
Representative McDonald present. Representative Miller.
Miller present.
Representative Miller present. Representative Moran.
Moran present.
Representative Moran present. Representative Mortensen.
Mortensen present.
Representative Mortensen present. Representative Robbins.
Robbins present.
Representative Robbins present. Representative Sundell.
Present.
Representative Sundell present. Representative Schultz.
Present.
Representative Schultz present. Representative Stevenson.
Present.
Representative Stevenson present. Representative Swazinski.
Swazinski present.
Representative Swazinski present. Representative Joachim.
Present.
Representative Joachim is present. We have a quorum.
Thank you very much, Ms. Griska. And we're not going to approve minutes today. Originally, it was sent out for April 9th, 2021, but I guess it's May 5th of 2021 was the last regular session meeting we had. And then we do have one special session meeting on June 18th, or interim meeting, whatever that was, I guess. So we're going to hold off, since you might not have had time to look at those minutes. We'll hold off and approve those at our next meeting. And so, members, as I've said in the past, the most enjoyable and rewarding part about being the tax chair of this committee is working with such top-notch members and staff as we have on the tax committee. So I thank you for that in the past and look forward to a great session coming up. And with that, we do have some new staff members that I would like to have them introduce themselves as I read their names off, if they would just come on and give a quick little background. And so we have Justin Cope with House Nonpartisan Research.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hi, my name is Justin. I'm the new legislative analyst. I'll be working on property tax, tax increment, financing, special assessments, and a grab bag of other tax issues. I'm from Minnesota, but spent the past few years in New York working at the Legal Aid Society, but happy to be back and working here with you all.
All right. Thank you very much. We also have a new GOP researcher, Kelly Cavanati. So, Ms. Cavanati, if you want to introduce yourself, there you are.
Yes. Hi, everyone. My name is Kelly Cavanati. I just took over for Stephen Rubis in Taxes World. I've been with the Minnesota House about 4 years, but spent 1 year on the Taxes Committee back in 2017. So I'm happy to be back. Thank you.
Welcome. And we have John Beeler, who is the DFL Research. Mr. Beeler?
Yes, good afternoon, everyone. John Beeler. I'm a New Jersey transplant, recently relocated to Minnesota and out of private legal practice. And I'll be taking over for Sean Haydorn while he's out on leave. And Sean will be back in March briefly. Looking forward to working with everyone.
Very good. Welcome. And of course, a new committee administrator, Polly Cerkvenik. Welcome. I know some of you or most of you have probably met her by now, but you'd introduce yourself.
Hello, everyone. My name is Polly Cerkvenik. I'm taking over Nathan Jessen's role as committee administrator for the Taxes Committee and the Property Tax Division. I've been at the House since 2019, working with Representative Pinto in the early childhood area as both the committee legislative assistant and the committee administrator, and excited to make the move over to taxes.
Very good. And as I mentioned before, and I hope you didn't miss that, the best committee in the legislature. So very good. So members, as we start the year off, you know, we've got a pretty big budget surplus right now, and residents are going to expect the legislature to get results. I think there's no two ways about that. And with that, I think, you know, we can make important investments and important tax cuts that are going to make people's lives better and easier and improve their quality of life. And while we're going to have a number of issues that I know the tax committee members and as a committee we're going to deal with, I think two that for sure I would like to concentrate on is still number one, dealing with COVID-19. We know that as individuals, if you were lower income before COVID-19, or if you did not have a job where you could work from home, you got hit harder than others. We also know in the business world, if you were leisure or entertainment or restaurant, fitness centers, you got hit harder. And so one of the main goals should be, again, like last year, to deal with helping people recover and rebuild from COVID-19. Another big area, which I personally think may be the biggest area as far as our economy, is the workforce shortage. You know, when you look at this workforce shortage that we have right now, it's driving up prices, leading to inflation, the supply chain disruptions. You look at healthcare, law enforcement, education, all of these areas looking for workers. It has a huge impact on our economy. And it's not like it was a big surprise. I mean, if you've listened to our demographers for the last two decades, they pretty much predicted that this would occur as baby boomers retire. There's just not enough young people replacing them. And actually by, I think it's 2042, in about 20 years, the death rate in Minnesota will actually, for the first time ever, surpass the birth rate. And so one of the things I'd like to see this committee really focus on is how can we retain, but also attract new individuals and new young families, young people, young families to the state of Minnesota. And so one of the things you're going to see in the next couple of weeks are some bills that are going to greatly expand the child care and dependent credit and the student loan credit. And these are efforts that members from both sides of the aisle have worked on and developed over the years. But to me, I think we have to do some game changers, really put Minnesota on the map, because we know for young families and people that child care costs is a big, big deal. Student loan costs are a big deal. And housing's another area that is really important. And so you're going to see some bills coming forward that are going to really be great expansions and trying to really attract attention and keep folks here. So the bottom line is, what we've done in the past, this tax committee has always used caution. We've been responsible, I think, in how we do things. And that's going to be important as we make sure we make important investments and important tax cuts for Minnesotans. So before we go on, Representative Hertaus.
Well, thanks, Chair Marquardt, and thanks for your reminder about the death rate surpassing the birth rate. I'm not looking forward to that.
No, none of us are. But, you know, the thing about it, and I remember listening to Tom Stenson and others talking about you know, this demographics and how things are going to happen. And as we all know, for some reason, every 12 months we get a year older. I mean, it's a sure, absolute thing. And so a lot of these things that are occurring now, you know, have been predicted. But sometimes as a legislature, we don't prepare for them, even though we've been warned they're coming down the line. So I'm hoping this workforce shortage is something we can really take a look at. So.
I've often said that for many of us, it's a 6-furlong race, and a lot of us are in that 6-furlong.
Thank you. Good to have you. Good to see you, everyone. But Representative Hertaus, good to see you again. So, members, with that, we're going to move to our first order of the day, and that is a presentation on the Beginner Farmers Tax Credit, which I think was put into effect under Chair Davids in 2017 in the House bill. As you're going to hear, it the sunset is the end of 2023. So we're going to listen to a proposal, or excuse me, listen to the report that was required by the legislature, and then open it up for questions and so forth afterwards. So we have Matthew McDivitt, from an agricultural finance supervisor from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Mr. McDivitt, if you would like to proceed.
All right. Thank you, Chair Marquardt. Members, my name is Matt McDivitt. I'm the agricultural finance supervisor for the Department of Agriculture. So I'll just share my screen here to go over just a real short PowerPoint presentation to kind of summarize what the program is for any that might not be familiar with it, or just as a refresher, and then I'll just kind of dive into some of the statistics as the report required. Feel free to stop me and ask questions at any point. So, okay, can everybody see my screen?
I think we can. I'm not seeing anyone indicating they cannot.
All right. So beginning farmer tax credit. Move on to – so the way the kind of credit works, generally speaking, the credit goes to the asset owner. So usually there's two parties involved. There's the beginning farmer, and then there's the asset owner. So the credit for the asset owner works this way. They can take a credit against state tax due in Minnesota. So if they're doing a sale of land or agricultural asset, they can take 5% of the sale price up to a maximum of $32,000 per beginning farmer they're working with. They also can take, alternately, could take 10% of the gross rental income in each of up to 3 years in a row to $7,000 a year. There's also an option to do a share crop, where they can get 15% of the cash equivalent of the gross rental income in each of the first 3 years. Here, the maximum is $10,000 per year. So definition of agricultural asset is land, livestock, facilities, buildings, and machinery. Owner of agricultural asset can be an individual, a trust, a pass-through entity. It, however, cannot be a C-Corp, equipment dealer, or a livestock dealer. So how do you qualify for beginning farmer? Resident in Minnesota, farm less than 10 years based off Schedule F. Obviously, the land you're farming must be in Minnesota as well. The asset owner cannot be a direct family member. They can be aunt or uncle or further removed. As of now, the net worth is set at $862,000 for the beginning farmer. That'll bump up here in the next week or so as we do an inflationary adjustment. So it'll probably go up another, you know, $10,000-$15,000 or so. They have to do the majority of the farm labor and management, and they are required to enroll in a farm financial management course unless they receive a waiver. So some high-level statistics. Tax year 2018, we had an initial infusion of $5 million. Overall, this was a $36 million proposal. In each year, 2019 through 23, another $6 million becomes available, and any remaining funds do roll over. So that's why for 2022, we're looking at about $19 million available. Currently, the program sunsets on December 31st of 2023. Quick breakdown of how many people have used the program. You know, we're sitting right around about 1,100 a year is about what it's coming in at as far as between asset owners and beginning farmers. So usually a little bit, it can sway back and forth because one point I'll point out here on the next slide is that beginning farmers can also just apply for an educational credit for up to 3 years. So that's why the number of beginning farmers can vary quite a bit. It would just depend on how many of them are just doing the educational portion only. That's kind of what this slide gets into. They can get a 100% credit on their farm financial educational costs up to $1,500 per year. They can get the credit for up to 3 years. And it oftentimes they use it in conjunction with the beginning farmer scholarship that the department also administers. Okay, I will move on. Are there any questions regarding the program itself before I dive slightly deeper into some of the statistics? Okay.
I think you can proceed.
Thank you.
Rep. Marquardt, I did have a question.
I'm sorry, Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. I was wondering on slide four, the eligibility part, what is the rationale of having to require generation skipping in order to be eligible?
Well, I guess you would have to for sure ask the people that put it into law. But generally speaking, I think there can be a couple of reasons why that might be happening. Number one, they're definitely in the case of renting or leasing assets. There could be significant fraud involved, as you know, it's pretty hard to. For people to check up to see exactly, you know, if their son or something rented 80 acres for $60,000, you know, do we, you know, then go digging around their bank account to make sure that they actually did that transaction, you know, an overvaluation of things. So I think generally speaking, that's kind of the main reason. It also could just be concerns about whether there would have been enough funds if you opened it up to family members or if that would have burned through the appropriation entirely, like really quickly.
Representative Hertaus, anything further?
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. Well, I guess if we want to keep people on the farm and be able to pass that on, you know, I think we should take a look at that as a possible remedy.
I'm going to go to Representative Davids because he was the chair when this bill came up.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chair Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The reason I have been worked very hard to make sure it couldn't go directly to family members was for that very reason, that there could be shenanigans going on. And yes, we want to get farms to families, but with this program, it's just a little too close. We want an arm's length transaction here. Now, Mr. Chairman, maybe something research. I thought in last year's tax bill, they changed that where you could go to family members. Did we change? I thought we changed that.
Yeah, Chair Davids, we had it in the House omnibus bill, but it did not make the final cut.
So my lobbying with the Senate paid off.
That's right. Yeah, we did put that in there. And there were some safeguards that would prevent, you know, or try to prevent some of the things you were mentioning, but
yes,
yeah.
And I appreciate that because there is a big move to do that, and I wanted arm's length transactions, and there's still some pretty good deals going on out there, but it could just get a little bit too cozy if it was with, you know, a son or a daughter, and so that's why we did that.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question to the testifier. You know, just looking at the RFA and the amount of applications you're getting into, my guess is since this program has come in, you've probably seen quite a bit of success with it. How is the department itself handling the workload? within itself? You know, do they need extra people to handle it? Where does that all sit as far as a timely response and try to adequately get these things processed?
Sure.
Mr. McDavid.
Yes, Representative, well, it can be challenging. When this initially rolled out, I think the Rural Finance Authority asked for one FTE to help administer the program because it is quite large. And it's definitely challenging, you know, with 1,100 applications, it's a lot. And it's pretty much paper driven because we don't have any money for infrastructure to do online applications or the like. I don't know if Andrea wants in. Well, part of it part of it too is we get such a huge influx come the deadline. So right now the deadline is October 1st so that we can get through all of them by the end of the year. And we probably get about 400 of the applications in the last 2 weeks of September. And it gets a bit overwhelming. I don't know if Assistant Commissioner Vobel would have anything she'd like to add to it.
Assistant Commissioner Vobel, anything to add to that?
Hello, thank you so much, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Andrea Vobel. I serve as Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And as you mentioned, Representative Swazinski, we are going to have a request. We did get an overwhelming response to this program, which is wonderful, but we also have gotten an influx of requests for our loans through Rural Finance Authority. And we've got a lean and mean team, but they definitely need help to make sure that we're getting these things through timely and not overworking our staff. So we do have a request to allow for some of these funds to be able to use for administration solely for the reasons you brought up.
Very good. Representative Swazinski, anything?
Well, that sounds good. I think actually I might be dropping a bill for that tomorrow. So you folks can look up for that bill and we might be able to help you out.
Very good. Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly support the program enthusiastically. Woodbury is a long way from Yellow Medicine County, but I know that some land in Yellow Medicine County is going for over $10,000 an acre. A young family with the asset of just 100 acres would have more than $1 million worth of assets. Is this program going to be enough to help people who are still farming small pieces of land or don't have or have a bit more than the $800,000 of assets?
Mr. McDavid.
Representative, the net worth thing is what it is. It's written into the law, so there isn't a whole lot there. But as far as smaller pieces of land, you know, a lot of times what this program does is it gets people access. We do hear lots of stories of, hey, you know, I was trying to rent some land from a landlord and it was down to me and three people and I got the land because the landlord got the tax credit. Yeah. So we hear quite a bit about that. So sometimes it's not even necessarily, you know, it is about the money, but it gives access to the beginning farmer. And sometimes the beginning farmer does get a little bit of a break on it too. We'll see some contracts where the landowner will kick them back a little bit of the money or cut a little bit of the rent off as long as they're getting a tax credit or on the sale. So it can benefit the beginning farmer in a more direct monetary way as well.
Well, thank
Representative Sandell.
Mr. Chair, thanks very much, and good luck with the bill. It's a terrific help. Thank you.
Very good. Chair Davis.
Well, thank you, Chair Marquardt. It's encouraging to find out that people are actually listening to Tax Committee. I just had one say, did you really lobby the Senate against this provision? That was in jest. I would never have gone behind your back to do that. I would have told you up front. So no, that was supposed to be sorry. Sorry.
Well, Representative Davis, I know you did not, so I can verify that.
And Mr. Chairman, I do believe, I just thought it went in too, because it was in the House tax bill. Why wouldn't it have gone all the way through? So that's interesting. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Any other questions at this point? All right, Mr. McDivitt, please continue.
All right, Chair Markworth, thank you. I'll just get into a little, some of the statistics here. So you previously I had showed you those were the applications that we get in. So we submit those all to the Department of Revenue, and then they process them through as far as what people put on their taxes. So if you look at this, you'll see that people that actually claim the tax credit are somewhere around 10 to 15% less or below beneath the applications we have approved. So 2018, we had 407 asset owners claiming about 2 million. 2019, 540 for 2.4, and 2020, 620 for a little over 2.4. So we don't have the 2021 numbers just yet because we'll have to wait to get through the 2021 tax year. Beginning farmers, with about 325 of them for 317,000 in educational credits. 2019, 418 for 434, and 2020, 382 for 472. As you can see, there are just some carryover amounts. So those are some of the people that didn't claim them, at least as of yet. Sometimes people file some extensions and things, so there can be some lagging, but that's kind of what's on the table there. Tax credits by category. So we kind of broke it out here by year, and then lease purchase or share crop. So leases is far and away the largest category, which is no surprise. However, it's not the largest amount. So 367 leases for a little over a million in 2018, did 50 purchases for slightly higher than the lease amount of over a million, and then not a ton of share crops. But as you see, the numbers stay pretty consistent year to year. Obviously, 2020 is, you know, a little bit larger than 2018. You know, it took the program a little while to kind of get rolling and everyone get aware of it and things like that. But the last 2 years, it's been pretty close as far as the numbers. Little breakdown by geography. So we just broke this out by geocoding based on regions of the state. So generally speaking, southwest is by far the largest. It was in 2018 as it is in pretty much every year. Not a ton of Twin Cities Metro. There was some early, but not last year. We only have 2 years available on this because the coding wasn't available from revenue. So we only have 2 years of history on the location of the these first two tables here are just the asset owners. So that's where the land is involved as far as location in the state. And the bottom part of this here, this is where the beginning farmers themselves reside. Generally, this is going to be fairly similar to the above in that they are generally doing transactions in their same region, but depending on some geography things, you know, not necessarily. So sometimes, you know, you'll see some of the asset owners, they might reside in the Twin Cities Metro, but they do have farmland elsewhere that they're selling or leasing. And then there was just kind of a breakdown of what the regions involve. So I'll just kind of pause here if everyone just kind of wants to take a look at it. They can understand what counties that they represent, what region they would be categorized in.
And Mr. McDivitt, as members are looking at that, I wanted to remind those who are viewing this committee that if you want to find out any of this information or any of the information that members have that we're dealing with at any committee, go to the Minnesota Legislature website, then go to the Minnesota House of Representatives, then to committees and divisions, and then to taxes. And if you go to the lower right on that screen, that's where you're going to find all of these materials.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Markworth. To finish up here, we had to talk about farm financial programs. So we have a list of approved farm financial programs right here. Generally speaking, most of what we have is accredited type institutions. We see a lot from like Southwest Minnesota Farm Business Management and, you know, other Minnesota State colleges and universities. That's a very large part of where the education comes from. We do have some independent farm business management instructors that have submitted for approval. So the way we do that is they can send us a resume as well as their kind of course structure, and then the Rural Finance Authority can approve them to be an approved instructor for this program, which we have the approval process on the last page here. That completes the report, and I'm willing to take any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. McDivitt. I will start with this. So if you were to rate from one not being very helpful or productive versus 10 being very helpful, a very good program, how would you rate this in terms of helping beginning farmers and helping agriculture in the state? I mean, rate the success of what, in your mind, this program has done.
Okay, Chair Marquardt. Well, I think we're probably somewhere between, you know, nine or 10. I mean, I think it's been really successful. It's helped a lot of people. There, you know, obviously there's some tweaks we could make to it to make it run a little smoother and be a little easier to administer and all. But, you know, we get a lot of good stuff from our beginning farmers and asset owners that are very excited about the program and, you know, think that this is something that is one of the better programs that the state has. They really see a lot of value in it.
Very good. Thank you. And so, you know, basically about six, after it was $5 million in the first year and then $6 million kind of set aside for each of the next years. And I suppose we're spending about $3 million, roughly half. So any ideas or any thoughts on improving this or to getting more involved? Because, you know, and I don't know what the thinking was on the $6 million originally. Maybe it was just you didn't really know for sure and you set it at six and it's going at three right now. And I don't know. And Chair Davids might be able to give us some information on that. But is it not getting to people still that we think we could? Is everyone informed of this program that know it's out there? I mean, is there anything that we could help enhance it?
Sure. Yeah, I think we've gotten the word out pretty well. I mean, obviously you can't get to everybody. And, you know, as far as your reach, you know, we go through social media, we go through farm business managers, we go through tax accountants and things of that nature to kind of broadcast this out. So I think generally speaking, we've got the word out as about as well as we're going to. As far as administering it again, you know, comes back to, you know, having a little bit of a budget would make it go quite a bit smoother, I think, for everyone involved, especially if you get some sort of online application. We have a couple of just small changes that we've suggested in, I think, some of the proposals that might come across. So to just make it a little easier to administer on our side, nothing too groundbreaking or anything like that. But I think that pretty much sums it up. I don't know if Assistant Commissioner Vobel has anything she'd like to add.
Assistant Commissioner, anything?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think there's certainly a lot of interest. Back to your question about, this is one of the, you know, most premier programs nationwide. We get questions all the time from other states about how we were able to get this across the finish line because it's just been so beneficial for beginning farmers. So just a huge thank you to everyone who made that possible. And we, as Matt suggested, we are looking to expand it a little bit more. We do see that there's a need, and certainly we've got the funding that to cover that. So look for more on that, but we certainly think that there's an opportunity to serve more people than we already have.
Thank you very much. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. What does your typical beginning farmer look like? I know there's been discussions with many of the men and women coming out of the military trying to encourage them to get into farming. What is the typical beginning farmer looks like? I mean, what type of person are we talking about?
Mr. McDivitt.
All right, Representative Detmer. It's a little bit hard to say because we don't ask for a lot of specific demographic type questions, but in talking to different farmers, they tend to be in your 22 to maybe 37 year ish age group. Generally speaking, some provide a little more financial information than they need to. So, I would say generally probably people's average net worth is probably more around the, $400,000 to $500,000 range on those that do submit that information. A lot of these cases, this is the difference between them getting or not getting land. So they really appreciate this opportunity. And sometimes they get, a little financial benefit off it themselves. And at the same time, the farm financial programs are also very beneficial for them. It helps their long-term success. And the fact that the costs are covered, there's really nothing to lose there. That's just a win across the board as far as that goes.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. Now, over the last few years, there's been discussion encouraging the veterans when they're coming off active duty or they're completing their mission and their service to take a look at the farming industry and encourage them to go. And a lot of them have been asking questions of how do we do it. So that's just something I needed to bring up with this group.
Thank you. Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. And I really appreciate Representative Detmer's question because I was really interested in trying to understand more of has this program actually encouraged the diversity in farmers in our state? We know that a lot of the farmers who actually supply a lot of most of the produce actually in farmers markets rent their land and that they often almost never own the land that they work on. So I would love to just maybe understand more of have we seen diversity in increasing diversity in our farmers and those who own land, because when you don't own the land, it's really hard for you to generate the assets that might be able to allow you to actually create wealth. And a lot of times then people, when they're done farming, they have no wealth. All they had was the sales that they got from their produce. And so I would love to kind of see how that is developed, particularly for this program. And my apologies for not knowing much about the program. So I'm really interested in learning more about it and understanding it better too. It sounds like a great program.
Mr. McDivitt, anything on...
Yeah, well, it's, Representative Herr, as far as diversity goes, again, we can't track any information like, race or location. So, we got location, obviously, but their thing. But, as far as understanding how many we might get from some of the smaller communities, very difficult to tell. I'm not sure that there's a big splash as far as that goes. We do talk with, the different organizations like Latino Economic Group and Hmong Farmers Association. So they are aware of the program. I don't get a lot of direct people reaching out to me, though, say, asking for assistance on filling some of these things out. Our application's really pretty simple, but, we're always available to assist anyone with it as well. That's probably about the best I can answer that, unfortunately.
Representative Herr.
Yeah, just a quick follow-up. Thank you, Chair Marquardt. And Mr. McDowell, thank you for the response. I know that when we set these up, we don't always sort of set it up with parameters in place to help you have the resources to do some of this work, but I would really encourage the department to figure out how maybe you might want to do it. I know you got a lot of applications, and 1,100 is a lot, and I appreciate the work that's being put into it, but I also think that as we look through the disparities in ownership of and try to close that wealth gap, I think it is really important for us as a state to actually collect that data and take a look at what is happening around it. I was in Rochester, I think a year ago, And there was a group of API farmers who were going to start their own sort of, they were talking about how they were going to be a collective of individuals who are going to start this big farming endeavor. And when I told them, well, their state has resources, they said, well, they had never heard of it. And I think that that's part of our problem as legislators is that we allocate money and then we have no accountability at the end. And I think that it is really important for us to ensure that community knows and what is it that we need to do to ensure that communities of color, diverse communities, actually understand what is available to them, because they can't come ask you for help if they don't know those things exist. So we're constantly in this perpetual cycle of we keep trying to do more and people don't get the information and then they don't have access. And so I would encourage us as legislators to think about then how do we need to adjust this to ensure that we have accountability in understanding the work and how it's impacting our communities, but also as a department, as your work, what are the things that you want to collect so that you know if you're making the kind of impact that you would want to make in creating diversity within these programs.
Representative Hur, thank you. Assistant Commissioner Vabil, did you?
Yes, sir, I just wanted to add to that. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hur is capturing so many important points. I just wanted to speak a little bit to, we did establish an Office for Emerging Farmers this last cycle, this last budget cycle. And one of the goals, along with the Emerging Farmers Working Group that was developed as well, is to look at the internal programs of the agency, including this, the Beginning Farmer Tax Credit program, to figure out ways that we can overcome some of those barriers to get the word out. We are asking for some additional dollars to help with, particularly on translation for outreach materials, because to your point, we hear that a lot, that it's just, you know, the way we're getting the word out is not accessible to everybody and not, not the, you know, the best way to do it. So we're working on different strategies for that. And then also, you know, the capturing of, you know, how we're doing, as you said, accountability and seeing how, if we're making progress. So that's another thing we're working on within the agency. And kind of looking at, you know, is there an option for maybe, you know, capturing just a certain amount, a certain percentage of the amount we're given for this program to show that we are there's money available for minority communities to be able to access these funds. We've had conversations about that. So you are hitting exactly the right thing, and we'd be happy to keep talking through some of the ways to make this a better and more accessible program. So thank you.
Before I turn it over to Representative Davids, who was the chair of the Tax Committee when this bill was put into effect, is there any other members who have questions or comments? All right, Chair Davids.
Okay, was my hand still up, Mr. Chairman?
It still is, yes, it still was, but I think you should have the last word anyway.
Okay, this was a bill, if I remember correctly, I believe Representative Pearson carried this bill, and we all worked together on this to get it into the omnibus bill at the time, and you heard that it's worked beautifully, and hopefully we can keep that record going.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Mr. McDivitt, Commissioner, Assistant Commissioner Vabil, thank you for making this presentation. And so, it sounds like it's working as intended, and it's always good to have these reports. That's why we do these. And these tax expenditures, get a report, see how it's working, and see if it's doing what we want it to do. So it's adding transparency to the whole process, which is good. So the legislature would have until 2023 to extend this program. So because it sunsets December 31st of 2023. So, all right. Thank you, everyone. Thank you again for the presentation.
Thank you.
So next, we're going to move to House File 2765. Representative Stevenson, welcome to your committee. Would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would move House File 2765 be laid over for further consideration.
For possible inclusion into the House Omnibus Tax Bill.
That would be ideal.
Very good. Before we go any further, you have an A2 amendment. Would you like to move the A2 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move the A2 amendment, which makes some technical changes after consulting with the Department of Revenue.
All right, yeah. As far as I looked through, it looked like technical changes. Any questions or comments on the A2 amendment? If not, as we call for the vote, I would like ask you to unmute yourselves. So all those in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
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 Those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Aye.
The motion does prevail. The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Stevenson, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is a bill relating to an issue that we discussed at some length last session, which is the tax treatment of unemployment benefits during the pandemic. Members will remember that in the early stage of the pandemic, two things, there was kind of a perfect storm at the UI department. One is that we saw a record level of claims. I recall that there were more claims in the span of a week than we had saw in the previous year. The department did an excellent job of trying to process those claims as quickly as possible, but they were very much overworked. At the same time, the federal government passed a supplementary unemployment insurance benefit that increased the amount that people on unemployment could receive. The unemployment insurance division, in an effort to get that benefit out as quickly as possible to people who were experiencing unexpected economic catastrophe, made the decision to not withhold taxes from those supplemental uninsurance benefits. And so at the end of the year, people who received those benefits were going to be facing an unexpected tax bill on their unemployment insurance benefits. And there were a number of members, myself, Representative Garofalo, others who were very concerned about that, wanted to make sure that we did not stick people who were suffering from unemployment and in a global pandemic with a large tax bill. And so we had some legislation that worked its way through and eventually was included in the House Omnibus Tax Bill. And thanks to Chair Marquardt and the conferees from the House, was included in the final agreement. A subtraction of we conformed with the federal government's approach and had a $10,200 subtraction for unemployment insurance last year. But it was only for tax year 2020. And of course, it's sad. I'm sad to note that the pandemic persisted into 2021 and the economic difficulties that we faced persisted into 2021. And so people continue to claim unemployment in 2021, and we want to continue the approach that we took in 2020 into 2021. And that's what this bill does, with some slight modifications, including a phase out for income. I would just note that the economic crisis that we experienced as a result of the COVID pandemic, as we have all discussed, did not fall equally across our population. And in fact, between 2019 and 2020, unemployment insurance claims in Minnesota increased most significantly among women, those with less than 12 years of education, and people under the age of 22. While UI claims fell between 2020 and 2021, they are still significantly higher compared to 2019 in the areas of educational services, healthcare and social services, and retail trade. Probably not a ton of surprises there. This bill, there's a revenue estimate, I think, in the virtual packet that shows that it has a relatively modest cost to the state, just about $170,000 in lost general fund revenue, and it, I think, would make a large impact for the people who would receive it. So I would ask for the committee member support, and happy to answer questions.
So, Representative Stevenson, it's about $160.9 million.
You're right. Okay. Mr. Chair,
for the record, just a slight difference.
But sorry.
$161 million.
You're, of course, correct. That would be really remarkable if it was $170,000. Yes. But still, in the grand scheme of things, it's a relatively modest amount relative to what we are dealing with here at the state. And so I would ask for member support.
Thank you very much. Before I go to members, I want to ask, is there anyone who would like to testify for or against House File 2765 as amended? And as far as I know, there was no written testimony, as far as I know. Ms. Cervenek can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think there was. So, members, all right, she's shaking her head no. So, members, questions? So, you know, last year we did this, and it was probably more of a conformity because the federal government was doing this last year. This year, the federal government is not doing it. So, you know, Minnesota would be doing this on its own. But much like last year, what happened last year is that, as Representative Stevenson accurately described, is that Deed and others, when they were getting these funds out, did not withhold anything. And that is what I have found out occurred now for 2021, is that this was not withheld, which means folks are going to get a bit of a sticker shock when they see their tax bill and you know, this extra income, nothing was withdrawn from it. So that kind of stays the same as last year too. So any questions or comments for House File 2765 as amended? Seeing none, Representative Stevenson, any closing comments?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing this bill. I think it's important to a number of people across the state. I've been getting emails about it since I carried this bill last year, so people are following up this year asking questions. So I appreciate you hearing the bill and hope we can include it in the tax omnibus. Thank you, and I'll renew my motion.
All right. Representative Stevenson renews his motion to lay over House File 2765 as amended for possible inclusion into the tax omnibus bill. Members, that concludes our work for today. We have not set up a meeting. There will, I'm almost sure, be a meeting next week. And that will kind of be the, next week will kind of be the last week where there won't be kind of meetings, but we're looking at bills and so forth. So I'm looking at least one meeting next week, but that might be about it. But then starting with February 14th, that week, you know, expect a pretty full schedule after that. So with that, members, oh, Representative McDonald, I see a thumbs up, and it looks like your hand is up also. So Representative McDonald.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, thumbs up because we're done with the committee. Good work with some of the bills. But say, in regards of meeting in person, now I know we're all Zooming, but we meet in person on the House floor in great numbers. Is there any chance, Mr. Chairman, that we'll be able to meet in person for these important committee hearings?
Great question, Representative McDonald. I know as of right now, the Speaker has said we will be meeting remotely, but she has also indicated we're going to see how things play out. So, you know, we'll have to stay tuned. But it is what it is right now. But, you know, it doesn't mean it could not change as we move later on and the pandemic changes and so forth. So we'll have to wait and see.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I certainly hope that we can. You know, of course, Ireland and UK and Denmark, to name a few.
Yep. No,
all in person. Everything's back to normal. So we pray that the Speaker will see to that wisdom and do the same here for the legislature. That's my input for today, Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Representative McDonald, I think everyone enjoys and, you know, would like to meet in person. I think that is the best way to do it. But, you know, right now we do have still, I mean, the pandemic is still with us. And, you know, give Speaker Hortman credit. She has really gone the cautious path. And I think when it deals with health and safety, I think that's the way to go. But in the future, if things change, we could be back to in person. We'll just have to wait and see. So. Members, with that, have a great rest of the week, and we are adjourned.